This is American Dissident Voices. This is a program speaking for Americans who believe in freedom rather than in political correctness, who value quality above equality, and are willing to do whatever must be done to restore America to racial and moral health and her public institutions to sanity and integrity. This is a program speaking for Americans who dissent from the United States government's policies of multiculturalism and enforced diversity and globalism. This program is the voice of America's dissidents who are speaking out to America's patriots and to patriots of our Western civilization around the world in order that we may learn together and work together for a better future for us all.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. This week, we're happy to welcome back to our microphones the director of the Institute for Historical Review, Mr. Mark Weber. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be on the show again.
Before we get into the main subject of our show, Mark, I know that this week there's going to be a couple of Ernst Zundel-related events that the Institute is taking part in. Can you tell us about those briefly?
Yes. We're coming up on the second anniversary now of the detention in solitary confinement in a detention center in Canada of Ernst Zundel. He's a German-born activist, writer, most noted for his role in two large trials that took place in Toronto in the 1980s. For nearly 2 years now, he's been held in solitary confinement by the Canadian authorities on the really ridiculous pretext that he's a danger to national security. It's really an outrage. I call him, and others have characterized him, as not only a political prisoner, but the most prominent political prisoner in North America right now. The pretext is really bogus. It's an empty one, as even neutral observers who don't even like Ernst Zundel's views particularly acknowledge. The most prestigious daily newspaper in Canada, the Toronto Globe and Mail, on two occasions has published editorials saying that the incarceration of Zundel in this way is an assault against the freedoms of all Canadians, that it's a pretext, that it's motivated for reasons that are not grounded in national security. And others have also spoken up against it. Now, the case has gotten very little attention in the United States because Zundel's much better known there. But it should be better known here in this country, and we're trying to do what we can about that. On Friday, the 4th of February, we're going to be holding a demonstration outside the Canadian consulate in downtown Los Angeles, and this is going to coincide with some similar demonstrations at other Canadian diplomatic missions in the United States. We'll be giving a letter to the Canadian consulate, similar to one that we gave to the Canadian consul a couple of years ago, when just after he was arrested. And then the day before, Thursday, February 3rd, Ernst Zundel's wife, Ingrid Rimland Zundel, who lives in Tennessee, will be speaking at an IHR meeting out here in California. And we have information about that posted on the homepage of our website, IHR.org. She's going to be reflecting and talking about the arrest, the outrageous arrest and incarceration. What's really one of the outrageous features of that is that it's highly unusual for a man like Zundel, who was going through all of the normal procedures to regularize his status here as a resident of the United States, would have been arrested in this way, especially considering that he's married to an American citizen. Ingrid Rimland is a U.S. citizen. There's no real proof of it yet, but there's been a lot of talk that the operating force behind this was this fellow Chertoff, who is the new Secretary for Homeland Defense in the United States, and that's very ominous. He's a person who's he's the son of a rabbi, and he has a record of going after people in the name of fighting terrorism. But the case against Zundel is a particularly outrageous one. I urge everyone who's listening to my voice to learn more about it from our website or the Zundel site, which is maintained by his wife. Anyway, those are two events that are coming up here. and there'll be other events in other places to coincide with that.
Very good. Please give my best to Mrs. Sundel and to Ernst Sundel if you communicate with him, and I wish those events all success. You said there was a connection, I wasn't aware of this, between Chertoff and what happened to Ernst Sundel. Do we have any evidence of this?
There's a little bit of evidence. Some records have come to light showing collusion between Canadian and American authorities to have Sundel arrested on February 5th at his home in Tennessee. And Chertoff was involved in some similar actions when he was in a previous position. But as I say, there's no—I don't know myself yet of any hard evidence of that. But there's been some talk of that. In any case, the situation is all the more ominous now that Chertoff is the new Secretary of Homeland Security.
Yes, the man is a fanatical Zionist, and what happened to Sundel certainly smacks of Jewish vengeance for his opposition to Jewish power and the Jewish media images of World War II.
Yes. Well, the Sundel case certainly received some sort of special handling because it's almost unheard of for a person in his position normally to have been arrested on the pretext in the United States that he missed a hearing with an American official. In fact, that's probably not even true, but anyway, whatever pretext was used, it's very unusual, especially, as I say, considering he's married to a U.S. citizen.
His imprisonment without charge is truly outrageous.
It is really outrageous. He's not permitted to have a pen. He writes with a pencil. He can't have a desk. The light in his cell is on 24 hours a day.
The man is treated worse than some murderers and rapists are treated.
It really is. Paul Fromm, who's been doing a great job of defending Ernst Sundel and publicizing his case in Canada, has stressed over and over the contrast between the outrageous treatment of Ernst Sundel, who, by the way, is a pacifist, has no criminal record whatsoever, whose life is essentially really an open book, and the kid glove treatment that known rapists, killers, and criminals from other countries have received from Canadian authorities.
Indeed. Well, Mark, it's coming up on the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz by the Red Army. And it looks like that quasi-religious holiday, Holocaust Remembrance Day, is going to come early this year.
We're going to get a double whammy this year, Kevin. Holocaust Remembrance Day, which began emerging as a major event on the American calendar in the late 1970s, and is now routinely remembered by political leaders. The Department of Defense advises military units to remember it and so forth. Now we get a double dose because this year, in addition to Holocaust Remembrance Day, which normally comes in April on the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943, we're also getting a lot of hoopla to coincide with the 60th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz camp. So on Monday, there was a large memorial service at the United Nations General Assembly, at which Elie Wiesel spoke. And for the first time ever in the United Nations General Assembly, prayers were said in the General Assembly.
So never before has there been any kind of prayer in the UN General Assembly.
That's what the newspapers reported, and so for the first time it's Jewish prayers. I guess the United Nations is supposed to have a kind of separation of church and state, but in this case, the usual walls are gone. So we're getting a heavy dose of this with not only these kinds of not only American but also international commemorations, coinciding with a great deal on television and in newspapers. There was a three-part series on television on PBS called Auschwitz Inside the Nazi State. Even the title is absurd. It's as if one was to characterize the Japanese internment camps in the United States in World War II as somehow emblematic or typical of the American state at that time.
Really?
Anyway, that's just by the by. But anyway, we're getting a pretty heavy dose of all of this right now.
Well, it's certainly a sign of Jewish power that 60 years after an alleged event, after many decades of wars and massacres, some of those wars and massacres the direct result of Jewish aggression, that the wartime experiences of one people only, are held up as unique, as the ultimate example of all that is evil, never to be forgotten, to be celebrated and actually monetarily compensated above any other event in human history.
Yes, well, this is the point I've been making in a number of interviews I've been giving, and we've made over the years, both in talks and in booklets and at conferences, that the Holocaust commemoration, despite the motives that are given for it publicly, is really an effort to create sympathy and support for Jewish Zionist goals and agenda. Now, having said that, it's really part and parcel of how Jews traditionally look at their own history. Jewish history, as they see it, is a long series of events, many of them cataclysmic, that show constant conflict between Jews and non-Jews throughout history. You know, the calendar of the Christian year is such as Christmas or Easter or events in the life of Jesus. The calendar in the Muslim, the dates in the calendar of the of Muslims are key events in the life of Muhammad. The key dates in the Jewish calendar are events in Jewish history and events such as Passover, when God supposedly killed all the firstborn of Egypt. But my point is that throughout history, Jews see this constant struggle between Jews and Gentiles manifest in the Inquisition in Spain, in the expulsions of from every European country at one time or another, in the story from the book of Esther in the Bible, in which supposedly the anti-Semitic prime minister or chancellor of Babylon plotted to kill Jews, was himself killed from ancient Egypt, and, of course, climaxing in the enormous outburst of anti-Jewish policy in Europe during the middle part of the 20th century.
You could say that their calendar is a calendar of war, death, and victimhood.
Well, one of the points that Jewish writers have made over and over is that an essential feature of the whole Holocaust story for Jews is that the Gentile is never to be trusted, that Gentiles, non-Jews, are always actual or potential enemies, and that this hatred of Jews is an essential part of the relationship between non-Jews and Jews going back to the beginning of time.
Well, it's getting to be a bit much, wouldn't you say, Mark? I just read a comment in the newspaper in Australia called The Age, in which they used the phrase Holocaust fatigue. Do you think anyone is suffering from Holocaust fatigue these days?
Well, the thing that will not really work about all of this is that however important this might be for Jews and how understandable it might be given Jewish history, it's really not going to stick for non-Jews because it has no transcendent real character. The point really is that we're all supposed to be very, very especially concerned about the fate and the suffering of Jews more than any other people. Now, that might work for a while and might work for some people with a heck of a lot of propaganda as we have in this country. In the United States, there's a almost built-in reflexive sense among Americans that Jewish suffering deserves more sympathy and attention than the suffering of any other people, that Jewish concerns should be American concerns. But that's a pretty hard thing to keep up forever. And it's a pretty hard thing to keep up around the world when, for most of the world, one of the most oppressive and rogue outlaw states in the world today is, in fact, the state of Israel.
Indeed.
It's a remarkable thing that, the whole world has seen the famous photograph from 1943 of a boy, a Jewish boy in the Warsaw ghetto with his hands up, and there's a German soldier in the background with a gun, and that's supposed to evoke sympathy. But similar photos like that come out weekly or daily from occupied Palestine with Israeli soldiers, not just holding, you know, passively holding a weapon, but beating or humiliating Palestinians. And those pictures are not only up to date, they're in color. And the world is a lot more aware of that, as it rightly should be, than of what happened in Poland 60 years ago.
Indeed. I've seen them by the hundreds on the internet. They're very easy to find. Yeah. You say that the story of unique Jewish suffering isn't sticking. There was a poll in Canada just the other day that found that 3 out of every 10 Canadians failed to identify Jews as the quote-unquote primary victims of the Holocaust. In fact, only 40% of the respondents could indicate that 6 million Jews died during World War II.
I want to put it a little bit into perspective, if I would, Kevin. Normally, it's a normal thing for events to recede in popular memory as time goes by. I mean, that's a natural thing. People are more aware of events that happened more recently.
Sure.
But in the case of the Holocaust, with the passage of time, the emphasis, the hoopla, the media devotion to this subject has grown. Anyone who's over, say, 50, 60 years old will remember that there was almost nothing about all this back in the 1950s or 60s. There were some, but nothing like the cascade that we've witnessed in the last 10 or 20 years. It grew really in the late 1970s. It was promoted by television. A number of books have pointed out that the formation of the President's Council on the Holocaust under President Carter, which later became the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, a federal government agency, was set up as a stop to Jewish interest at that time, political interest in the United States. And that's the important thing, that the Holocaust campaign isn't some neutral commemoration that comes out of a concern for humanity, but is an expression of Jewish power and is meant to further Jewish and Zionist interests. Just the other week, Tony Judt, who's a Jewish scholar and he's director of the Remark Institute at New York University, wrote an article in The Nation, a prominent New York periodical, and he had this to say on that subject. He wrote, "The Shoah, that is the Holocaust, the Hebrew word, is frequently exploited in America and Israel to deflect and forbid any criticism of Israel. Indeed, the Holocaust of Europe's Jews is nowadays exploited thrice over. It gives American Jews in particular a unique, retrospective victim identity. It allows Israel to trump any other nation's sufferings and justify its own excesses with the claim that the Jewish catastrophe was unique and incomparable. And, in contradiction to the first two, it is adduced as an all-purpose metaphor for evil everywhere, anywhere, and always, and taught to school children all over America and Europe without any reference to context or cause. This modern instrumentalization of the Holocaust for political advantage is ethically disreputable and politically imprudent." Now, that's a rare voice to say that, but there are other voices, even Jewish voices, who point out, who make the same point as Tony Judt does in this very recent article. For example, Israeli Holocaust historian Yehuda Bauer, professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, he said some years ago, quote, "Whether presented authentically or inauthentically, with empathy and understanding or as monumental kitsch, the Holocaust has become a ruling symbol of our culture. Hardly a month passes without a new TV production, a new film, a number of new books of prose or poetry dealing with the subject," unquote. Another Jewish official, Ian Kagadan, who was director of government relations of B'nai B'rith Canada, he talked about the importance of Holocaust propaganda in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism. And we've seen that manifest in many, many ways. One of them is that one country after another in Eastern and Central Europe has been shaken down for money to be given to Jewish organizations. He wrote in an essay published in a Toronto newspaper in 1991, quote, "In the moral, what he calls moral reconstruction of Eastern Europe, coming to terms with the Holocaust must figure prominently. He says, the Holocaust stands as Western civilization's greatest failure and achieving our quest of a new world order depends on our learning the Holocaust's lessons. What he really means when he says we is that Gentiles have to learn what we mean by the lessons of the Holocaust. A principal philanthropist of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, which is one of the most important Holocaust centers and a very ardent supporter of Israel and its policies, said this, and this was quoted several years ago in the New Republic by a Jewish writer. It's a sad fact, he said, that Israel and Jewish education and all the other familiar buzzwords no longer seem to rally Jews behind the community. The Holocaust, though, works every time. And the person who quoted him, Leon Wieseltier in the New Republic, said, his candor was refreshing, even if it was obscene. On the subject of the extermination of the Jews of Europe, the Jews of America are altogether too noisy. Well, there may be voices of caution like this, Kevin, but the noise is going to continue, and it'll grow. In fact, it's remarkable that the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz is receiving much more attention, much more hoopla and fanfare than the 50th anniversary.
Why is that, Mark?
Because, as Jewish leaders keep stressing, never forgive, never forget. When they say never, they mean never. And it's an important card to play. It's one of the few cards that Jewish and Zionist groups still have to play that sort of works, and so much so that they can play it even in the United Nations. Even though around the world, the tide, I think, is clearly running against Jewish and Zionist interests and power in a way that we haven't seen.
You're listening to American Dissident Voices, brought to you by National Vanguard Books.
Be sure to be listening to next week's American Dissident Voices program, when we'll continue discussing the bizarre yet dangerous farce, which is Holocaust remembrance, and its relationship to Jewish supremacist power. You'll also want to read writer Erman Vinson's in-depth treatment of this subject in the latest issue of National Vanguard magazine. You are listening to American Dissident Voices, brought to you by National Vanguard Books. The new issue of National Vanguard Magazine, number 125, is now available for purchase from National Vanguard Books. Bulk copies of the magazine, 20 or more, are also available at up to 50% off the cover price. Many of our members and supporters sell these at flea markets, cultural events, and quite a number even distribute them regularly to newsstands at a tidy profit. National Vanguard Magazine is a publication of the highest quality in every sense of the word, one that you will be proud to show to your friends and associates. This issue, our 125th, contains the following important features. How you can help, an editorial by yours truly, Kevin Alfred Strom. National Vanguard is a collaborative effort, and every reader can contribute in a significant way to our success. The Assault on Art and Beauty. Josiah Knott looks at the biological and cultural reasons that make Jews tend to work against beauty and oppose all manifestations of beauty as we see it in the art of the West. The Sign Man. Ben Parker's fictional look at a man who changed the world, even though he seemed to have nothing. Seemed is the operative word in this case. Situation Terminal But Not Serious, columnist and wit Bob Whitaker on The Legal Background to Gay Marriage, Petty Tyrants, a look at what Canadian and American society may become as book burning and imprisonment without charge become a reality, and Both Sides Equal One Side, a comparison of communist sham elections with American sham elections. Postscripts by Revelo P. Oliver. In The Price of the Head, Revelo P. Oliver looks at an egregious case of corruption in the academy, corruption that contributed to the deaths of thousands of Americans and the betrayal of a sacred trust.
Holocaust Commemoration, Part 2. Continued incisive analysis by Erman Vinson of the secular religion driven by Jewish ethnocentrism that is growing up around the Holocaust, and much, much more. You may subscribe or purchase individual or bulk copies of National Vanguard magazine at nationalvanguard.org or natvan.com. A 6-issue subscription is $22 in the U.S. One copy is $5 postpaid. In Canada, the subscription is $30, one copy, $5. And elsewhere in the world, the subscription is $40, one copy, $8. Write to National Vanguard Books, Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. That's National Vanguard Books, Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Or you may order online. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you to keep on thinking free.
You have been listening to a presentation of American Dissident Voices. The program was sponsored as a public service by National Vanguard Books, America's foremost supplier of patriotic books and tapes. You may purchase a high-fidelity audio recording of this program or any earlier program for $12.95 postpaid. In ordering program tapes, be sure to mention the date and the subject of the program and the call letters of this radio station. For $2, we'll send you our newest 72-page illustrated catalog with descriptions and ordering information for more than 600 books and tapes of interest to patriots. Many of the items in the National Vanguard Books catalog are available nowhere else. Our mailing address is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Please write that address down now, because you may not hear this program again on this station. The forces of political correctness do not believe in free speech, and they do not like this program. Our address again is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, that's 90, Hillsboro, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Visit us on the internet at www.natvan.com. That's spelled NATVAN.com. Or www.natall.com. That's spelled NATALL.com. These American Dissident Voices programs are sponsored by donations from listeners like yourself. Please send a donation today to help us keep these programs on the air. This program is pre-recorded and comes to you from the United States of America.